Hello and welcome to this, the first episode of the second Politeia podcast series, The Nations of Charlemagne. Today we're going to be discussing the history of Gaul, Celtic civilization to Roman province. I am very lucky to be joined by Marcus Furius Pertinax. Say hello, sir.
Hello, everybody.
And by Columba.
Hey, everyone.
Hi, in terms of why we're covering this topic, well, with the previous series, of course, we were trying to provide a broad overview of European history from Rome to modernity, especially from a certain lens, which could basically inform certain viewers as to a reactionary view of history. When it comes to this subject in particular, we're really going to be delving deep in terms of trying to dissect the identity of, in this case, France, Germany, and Italy. And I think, even though it's called Nations of Charlemagne, beginning at Charlemagne itself would, do a disservice to all of this incredible prehistory we have before the Carolingians, before the Magovians. So we're going to start off with Gaul, and as this series progresses, we're going to look at the origins of the Germans, Germania. We're going to be talking about the Great Migrations before we arrive at the Franks, Magovians, and the Carolingians. So, as this, is a talk on Gaul, I really want to sort of ask the question, what is a Celt, really, to start off before we l lead into the chronology and the sort of vast history?
Would you like me to go?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so the Celts, it is a famously ill-defined and sort of amorphous term, but it does go back a long way. I'm pretty sure Herodotus refers to the four barbarian races, and you have the
Yeah.
Persians, the Scythians, perhaps the Egyptians or the Africans, and then the Celts.
Yeah.
And so they're a huge group, and Celts were spread from Scotland, Ireland, etc., all the way to Turkey, some parts of Eastern Europe, etc. So they've got a long and complex history in terms of I suppose their ancestry, their deep ancestry, if you like. They're obviously an Indo-European people, right? Product of steppe people swinging east and then conquering agricultural peoples. This happened in the Bronze Age, and then cultures that we would recognize as properly Gallic, I would say, begin to form around the fit and probably about the 7th century BC, I would say. But of course there are legacies going back, like the focus on certain elements like sun worship, the importance of chariots, etc. These things have a very deep
Yeah.
history.
Could I sort of add something to that? Again, I'm not a specialist on this area in this area at all, but when sort of doing some research, I was quite interested to see in terms of the conception you gave, like the post-Bronze Age civilization, the beginning of Iron Age. As far as I'm aware, archaeologists tend to divide this into what they call the Hallstatt period. Hallstatt being a town south of Salzburg in Austria, which is basically seen to be the origin of Gaelic civilization. And then around the 6th century or so, we have the beginning of Latin civilization, which is another town, this time in Switzerland. One of the interesting things that I encountered when doing my research on this was the specific division between Gaelic and, or sorry, Gallic. Again, this is confusing. Gallic is very different from Gaelic, and Brythonic cultures. The hypothesis that again, a long-held hypothesis was that the Gauls expanded from that Hallstatt culture into Britain, but now that seems to be no longer the case. Rather, the Brythonic culture was already pre-existing in many ways older than the Gallic culture, which had expanded out from Austria and would encompass northern Italy, Illyricum, and what was then Gaul, but now we know as France.
I think there's certainly something to that, but they do share a lot of
Oh yes, I think
similarities in terms of material culture and art
yes,
and things like
and
that,
language, of course,
and
and
language, of
language,
course.
but rather it's that they come from a older sort of proto-Celtic grouping rather than again being specifically of the same grouping, which is something.
The one thing that I would add to that, sorry, is I'm pretty sure that the Hallstatt culture doesn't just describe Celtic populations, right? It would describe populations that would have been considered that spoke some Germanic languages, I think. Don't quote me on that. I might be wrong, but I'm pretty sure that's the case. But I mean the Hallstatt period is when you first start to see sort of true urbanization and and the forging of large international connections. You know, I mean, the largest site of the Hallstatt culture was the Heuneberg, and you know, they reckon it had a population of something like 10,000, and it was producing all sorts of fine goods, and it was a massive production center, and it had small villages and agricultural settlements around it, and what gets called a site hierarchy. You know, you have the core, and then the larger towns, and then the smaller villages, and so it was relatively complex. Yeah, but then and then we see the Latin culture, or the Laton culture come along, which as you say, named after a site in Switzerland. And this is when we start to see the sort of, I guess, they would get called the Asterisk and Obelix, with the very fascinating abstract art. You know, I it's very difficult to describe Latin art, but everybody knows the style, you know, with these very curving forms, etc. It begins to develop at that time, and develop in a remarkable way. I mean, you know, you have all sorts of wonderful deposits. I mean, that's the famous deposit in Lake Neuchâtel in Switzerland. It actually goes back all the way to the Bronze Age. There's Bronze Age swords and spears, etc. And then in the Iron Age, you see things being deposited all the way up into the Roman provincial period. And so you see the importance of these sacred sites have persisted longer than perhaps the Gauls or the Celts did, so we see very old traditions persist, and of course the Romans were aware of this to some extent. I mean, Diodorus Siculus comments on the fact that the Celts and the Germans were kin, etc., although funnily enough they didn't seem to realize that they were also related. I suppose political considerations weighed against making that determination.
Yes, I think it's also important to note, though, that the language is really, very distinct, though. How would you account for that?
What languages are distinct, sorry?
Germanic and at least Proto-Celtic, which would become Brythonic and Gallic languages.
Well, yes, there was a separation. I didn't mean to suggest that.
No, I'm just curious.
I couldn't say, but I mean, in terms of their languages, of course, they had been separate for quite some time, at least a millennia longer. But in terms of their religion, there are still a lot of similarities. I mean, they share the classic Indo-European religious pantheon, etc. Mm-hmm. Gods like, Caesar says that they worship Jupiter, Mercury, and Mars, but Lucan in his Pharsalia gives us the Celtic names, which is Taranus, Asus, and... I'm going to forget the other one. But this was, you have the sky father god, the lightning god. You have a god who is the protector of the people, and you have a god of, plagues and prophecy, who they would equate with Apollo or Mercury. So we do see these similarities.
Yeah, just on my research, one that occurred to me was Sisonius, who seems to be the Gallic equivalent of Mercury, Hermes. And in terms of protector god, we have Tutatis.
Tutatis, that's it, yeah.
Yes, Marcus, do you have anything to say on the prehistory of the Celts?
Not a whole lot. The Hallstatt culture is a little past my purview, but what I will sort of say is that, I think a lot of people who would look into the subject from a sort of a more peripheral or blighted perspective, who wouldn't have looked into the Gauls or the Celts more broadly in a wider sense, would not be aware that, the Celts themselves made their way into northern Spain, as we know as the Celti Iberians. I know we're going to reference it later, but they went as far into Anatolia with the Galatians. More often than once, they did humble their, you might say, more sophisticated southern civilizational neighbors in the form of Greece and Rome. I mean, they embarrassed Rome at the River Allia. They famously killed Philip II's elder brother Perdiccas in battle, and other Macedonian kings also fell foul of the Celts. I mean, they were very capable people who spread their influence quite far and wide.
I believe they decapitated the king as well, right? Ptolemy.
Yes. Yeah. Ptolemy Thunderbolt. Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. So, when we sort of confront the subject of Gaul, it tends to be concentrated quite solely upon Gaul and Caesar's Gallic War. Not us specifically, I mean people who aren't necessarily aware of the subject, and yet there is so much more to the Gauls and to Celtic European civilization more broadly, and over a very large expanse of time as well.
Yes, I mean, you brought up, you know, a lot of fascinating things. I mean, there's even a hypothesis that the Tarim mummies in China have some sort of distant connection with the Celts as well. You mentioned, the Celtiberi civilization in Hispania, you know, the Pannonii, which were, you know, on the Pannonian basin, which were now become Hungary. You talk about the Gauls in Turkey, modern day Turkey, called the Galatians. And you mentioned the death of Ptolemy Koulanos, the Ptolemy the Thunderbolt. I think, yes, important to note, you know, the sheer expanse of Gallic civilization at this point. You know, we're talking, you know, modern day France, northern Italy, southern Germany, Austria, Hungary, former Yugoslavia, and parts of Turkey as well, and even, you know, just a little bit. It's like Galatian guards served as the bodyguard units within Ptolemaic Egypt, as far as I'm aware.
Indeed.
Yeah, and they all share similar fashions and cultural traditions. I mean, you know, there's loads of reliefs of the Romans fighting the peoples in Dacia, etc. And they look exactly like Gauls. You know, they wear breeches, they have the same mustaches, they have torques, they have they have tall, greased, straight hair. You know, but yeah, which was the fashion. You know, they would put like pig fat in their hair and stuff like this, and run into battle naked, which is an image. But the Greeks had a lot of respect for the Gauls as warriors. I mean, the Hellenistic kingdoms, of course. When the Gauls invaded under Brennus and they were stopped at they weren't stopped at Thermopylae, they managed to get around. But yeah, when the Gauls invaded, or the Celts invaded, they got to Delphi, I think, and then they were finally crushed. But Pergamum, which is a Hellenistic successor kingdom at the time, and of course all the Hellenistic kingdoms are fighting each other. That's how the Gauls managed to do this, you know, because it's a very unstable situation. Pergamum seems to have commemorated their victory over the Gauls with you know, loads of statues. I mean, there's the famous statue of the dying Gaul, which demonstrate a respect for the Gauls. You know, he's got a very noble bearing, etc., and he looks like a fierce warrior. And of course, that's a part of the pride of the Greek victory. But yeah, we see that they were a constant thorn in the sides of the classical world.
Yes,
Just on the basis of the subject of the Greeks, it's not from the exact same perspective, I don't think. More maybe fear than admiration. But if you look at, for instance, the Battle of the River Alley in 390 BC, and the fact that they almost very nearly completely sack Rome, it's only really the capital that holds out, you know, the famous Geese of Rome, etc., and being sort of saved by Marcus Furius and what have you. But that instance has a massive impact on the psyche of the Romans, certainly in my view anyway. And there's almost this persistent anxiety that exists for centuries after that event. And it compels the Romans to firstly push north and then conquer and absorb Cisalpine Gaul, and then eventually to vanquish Gaul itself. And it's not really until Gaul itself is pacified and absorbed into the Roman sphere that this anxiety regarding these people, whom the Romans sort of possibly admire in one sense and definitely fear in another sense, is not ever vanquished.
Yeah, and there's also we see with Brennus, and funnily enough, this is a different Brennus who sacks Rome, as far as I can tell, from the Brennus who invaded Greece. It was far later, but
yes, correct.
Yeah. The invasion and the sacking of Rome, it did create, you know, the terror Gallicus, the fear of the barbarians. But it's interesting because it's also sort of presages the final destruction of Rome at the hands of, you know, vast migrations, because the invasion into the Hellenistic kingdoms and Rome by the Celtic peoples in the archaeological record is preceded by, I mean, we have the Latin and the Hallstatt cultures, and we see this urbanization. But around this time, when the Romans are reporting and the Greeks are reporting that we had these massive inflows of Celts, we see the urbanization peter out, and these big sites like the Hauneberg, they dissolve. And, you know, this seemed very sudden and abrupt to us, but if we read the Roman sources, if we read Caesar, we can see that, you know, tribes like the Helvetii were prepared to just get the entire population and pick up sticks and migrate. We see the presaging of Rome's final end there. We can understand the palpable fear there.
Exactly. And I mean, not I don't mean to go on a tangent quite so early, and I'll keep it brief, but it is almost a little bit reminiscent. It's not quite the same group of people, but it's quite similar to the Kimbrian Wars, and you're having this massive tide of people who literally venture all the way down the Elbe and Rhine rivers into, you know, through the gates of northern Italy into Rome. And again, it's another massive human wave of sort of northern barbarians, if we may call them that, and instilling utmost fear into these more civilized Mediterranean, you know, urbanized cultures that just see these waves upon waves of northern people, like you say, then sort of are important for the eventual destruction of the empire, you know, 5-6 centuries mm-hmm. later.
And we also see, you mentioned the Kimbrian Wars. This happened in around, what, 100-110 BC, I believe.
Thereabouts, yeah.
One of the consuls, I think, Lucius Cassius, his army was destroyed and enslaved by the victorious Germans. But we do see, there's this fear of just the northern barbarians more generally, and this was played on. I mean, famously, the Kimbrian War was ended by Marius at the Battle of Aqua Sextiae, and it's very interesting because, of course, Caesar was I think Marius was his adoptive uncle, and so Caesar draws on this, and indeed in his commentaries after he I think he wins a battle against this very same people, he mentions that he got revenge for Lucius Cassius, and then he brings up Marius, and so we see it play into his political program and his own political presentation, which, I mean, at the end of the day is the purpose of the commentaries, really. But yeah, exactly. It's fascinating how in some ways there's just this general fear of the northern barbarian.
Yes, a lot of the points you made there. I just want to sort of rewind a bit and talk about the specific etymology, you know, why the differentiation between Celts and Gauls. I think it's interesting to note that, you know, you mentioned Herodotus actually referred to them as the Celtale. And I think we commonly understand that they refer to themselves as Celts. In terms of the etymology of Gaul, I just want to sort of think aloud here. I've heard sort of two theories. One is that the word itself is of Celtic origin. The other theory is that there are two origins, one Greek and one Latin, the Greek one being Galatian, obviously from the Gauls in Turkey, having some sort of reference to milk, i.e., you know, light-skinned people. The other one I heard, Gali, in reference to the power or the terrifying people of the north. Could you elaborate on the etymology of Gaul?
I think those are, yeah, that's pretty much the arguments that are put out. There is an argument for a separation and one coming from Greece and one coming from Rome. I mean, I know that Caesar in the opening line of the commentaries, he says that in their tongue they're called Celts, and in our tongue they're called Gauls. So perhaps Gaul seems to be a specifically Roman appellation. No such thing is used by the Greeks, but yeah, those are the arguments. The one about fear is the one that's brought up a lot, and it was more popular in the past. Now they tend towards the Galatian explanation, which, I mean, I suppose the Greeks were in closer contact with the Turkic Celts or the Turkish Celts.
Can I also elaborate on that? The Greeks, of course, set up colonies throughout the Mediterranean world, you know, expanding all the way from Crimea, of course, with the Empire of Alexander. We have the Diadochi having, you know, Greek elite run kingdoms all across East Asia. But you also had Greek colonies in Sicily, such as Syracuse, and you had, most importantly, Greek colonies in Gaul. The one I'm talking about, of course, being Marseille, which would be known as Massilia. And when you mentioned the sort of the interaction between Greeks and Celts, I think it's important to emphasize that the Celts essentially didn't have their own form of written alphabet, but they did have a form of writing culture, and they wrote, in particular, they wrote in Greek. You know, there's evidence of the Celtic language being recorded in Greek, even though there's a great oral history attached to them.
Yeah,
I think this attests to the interesting trading relationship between the Greek port colony of Marseille and their relationship with the rest of the Gauls. And in fact, Caesar mentions this in his commentaries, that the further away from Marseille, the more supposedly uncivilized the Gallic tribes were, such as the Belgicae.
Yeah. But he also comments that the peoples who are closer to the civilization of our province are more effeminate, which I thought was it's an interesting comment. But yeah, I mean these things go back even further than that. I mean yeah, you have the Greek settlement, as you say, but even before the Greeks were properly established, there were interactions very early. I mean, there's the famous Vix burial, you know, which was, I think, about the 6th century. And, you know, you have the famous Vix crater, which is, a crater is a sort of a bowl that would be used to, or a giant vase that would be used, a pot rather, that would be used to mix wine, a symposium, etc. And it's Greek, you know, and you can see it in the Greek archaic style. It's massive, you know, it's like taller than a man, this huge, and it was buried with this rich princess who they reckon was a Celt, you know, and they have, yeah, Celtic burial traditions, etc. And so, yeah, we see this going back very far, this interaction with the classical world. But yeah, you have the colony of the Greeks set up, which then becomes the Roman province, Gallia Narbonensis, our province, which is basically the base of Caesar's operations.
It's just a bit of clarification on that point. I think Marseille itself remained a independent Greek colony until the actual civil wars of Caesar himself, when the Greek colony allied with the Optimate faction led by Ptolemy. In terms of you mentioned Marcus, the Battle of Alia, I think it's 390 or 387, and the subsequent sack of Rome by another Brennus. One interesting thing to note is that I think the tribe, the Gallic tribe leading that assault, were the Senones. And a bit of historic irony that the Senones would be one of the last tribes purged by Caesar at the end of his conquest in 50 BC. But in terms of like the so-called civilizing process, the conquest of the Gauls, as we mentioned, there were Gauls in northern Italy, and this area is known as Cisalpine Gaul during this time. I think what really, you know, precipitates the conquest of the Gauls in that region is, I think it happens around the year 212. And obviously, you know, for the more sort of astute listeners, people will know that that's during the time of the Second Punic War. Hannibal had crossed over the Alps some 6 years before, and he relied very much not only on Gauls in the north, but on certain Italic allies against Rome. I think you see the crushing and subjugation of the Gauls in the north as part of this process again of punishing those who allied with Hannibal. In terms of Gallia Narbonensis, and you know, the region of what we now know as, you know, Provincia Provence, that region I think was subjugated around the same time as the Cimbrian War, so the year 120, and then that became the province of Transalpine Gaul. You know, the significance of us mentioning all this is that when Caesar will begin his conquest of Gaul, he would be the governor simultaneously of three provinces: Transalpine Gaul, Cisalpine Gaul, and Illyricum. So I think, you know, unless anyone has anything to I mean, maybe in terms of trying to explain a bit more about Celtic culture, Gallic culture in particular, you mentioned the nomadic aspect. On the flip side of that, unlike in Germany, there had been significant deforestation of Gaul during the Hallstatt period, and you had a thriving agricultural sector in Gaul at the time. Yeah, I think the common assumption now is that agriculturally, the Gauls were on par with the Romans. They definitely weren't architecturally on par with the Romans, militarily on par with the Romans in terms of engineering, but you did have, you know, small urban centers called the Oppidum, you know, like Bibracte, capital city of the Aedui. And on top of that, you had an incredibly rich metallurgical tradition emanating from Gallic tribes, which is, you know, we have these amazingly preserved artifacts. In particular, you mentioned the torques, these beautiful golden torques, which were, again, a symbol of nobility and status.
The mirrors are wonderful as well. But yeah, I mean that in and of itself doesn't necessarily prove a lot of settlement, I would say, or sedentary lifestyle. I mean, famously, you can look at the artifacts of German, you know, barbarians and Vikings and very mobile peoples, and it's the most intricate, you know, beautiful work you could imagine. Yeah. Arguably as good as anything that the Romans produced. Very, very interesting stuff. Where are we going to go next? Are we going to talk about Caesar's conquests, or do you want to?
Can we just stick on the technology just for a brief
sure.
Couple things I want to say. One, may I echo an excerpt from a book here regarding technology? It's only like a short paragraph. Okay. The Roman historian Pliny, writing in the 3rd century AD, provides the only written account of the device, this being an agricultural device, by the way. On the vast estates in the provinces of Gaul, very large frames fitted with teeth at the edge and carried on two wheels are driven through the corn, and by corn they mean cereal, like wheat, a team of oxen pushing them from behind. The Romans named it the Gallic Valus. Historians didn't believe it could be true until a bas relief sculptures were discovered that apparently showed just such a contraption in use. Now, not too bad for a bunch of metalworking savages in the northern forests for them to develop such a piece of equipment.
And we see the Romans borrow. I mean, we see Caesar when he conquers the Veneti, which are a tribe on the Atlantic northern coast of Gaul. They're seafarers, and they have sort of ships with a shallower draft, and a broader broader width. And of course, they can cope better in the rougher northern waters. And so, what does Caesar do? He's pretty sure he ordered his legions to build like 600 of them or something. So the Romans weren't too proud, they take whatever they needed. I mean, we see them doing that as well with the Spatha,
Carthage, and the Carthage. I was just thinking earlier again, they did the same thing with the Carthaginians.
This is about Gaul, so I don't want to venture too much into the Roman aspect of it here, but it is amazing when you consider just how much of like sponges the Romans were when they came across things which are superior to their own, and they were quite, like you say, Columba, unashamed to adopt things which were better. Mm-hmm. And just if you even look at their military technology specifically, right? I mean, chainmail, to my understanding, was developed by either the Gauls or the Germans. It was certainly a North European thing that sort of came into the Mediterranean from the north. The Romans adopted with the use of the middle republican legionnaires, the Principes, and then onto the standardized legionnaire of Marius. They used chainmail. The gladius, the Romans did use a short sword prior to the gladius, but as when they're in contact with the Celtic Iberians specifically, they sort of make the gladius the sword that we know today. The various types of helmets that they have found regarding the coolest helmet, I think it's one's called the Montefiore helmet, Montefortino type.
Yeah.
They're basically mimics of Gallic designs. And the Gauls have these wonderful sort of ornate but effective items which are combat effective and useful. And the Romans go, hang on a second, we would be fools to not adopt this. And they adopt it en masse. And then if they've absorbed something from the Greeks, it's military organizations. They've basically got Celtic metallurgy, Celtic technology, and then merged it with sort of the Greek way of warfare, and that creates the Roman army that we come to understand in its various forms: the Polybian Legion, the Republican Legion, the Marian Legion. It's kind of like a fusion of those two influences, in a way.
We would also do well to point out, I suppose, in terms of technology and culture, the Gauls were obviously very they could be very mobile, and they were primitive, I guess, in terms of statecraft by Roman standards, but they did have the ability, it's not too dissimilar to the Greeks, classical Greece, where you have loads of different city states and kingdoms, etc., but they will come together for the Olympic Games, and they will go to the Delphic Oracle, etc. We see similar things going on with the Gauls, particularly, not so much the Celts as a whole, it's too broad, but Gaul particularly was conceived of by the Gauls themselves as a sort of supranational polity within the broader Celtic diaspora, I suppose. I believe it was the land of the Carnutes. They were a tribe pretty much dead center in the middle of Gaul, and that was considered, because it was the sort of omphalos of Gaul, the center, it was a very sacred place, and the people would come here to make very important decisions. They would send representatives, etc. I think they would also have the Council of the Druids there, and there was a sort of arch druid who was either elected, or if they couldn't decide, there was a fight, or occasionally there would be battles, etc. But we see the Druids acting as a sort of supernational force in some ways. They're not restricted just to their particular tribe. They interchange and they settle disputes. And so, very interesting. They also had the power of excommunication, effectively. Caesar comments on this. They could restrict someone from practicing any sacrifices or offerings, and they would cut them off from the gods, etc. Do you want to talk about the Druids now? Because I'd love to get into
them. We very much anticipated, a lot of questions. I was going to make a question pertaining to the Carnoutie region in particular, and I think it extends from this period until the actual conquest and the later prohibition of the Druids. But yes, very much so. Before we get on to the beginning of the Gallic Wars, I very much would like to address some Celtic mythology and the Druids in particular, because the Druids are a very unique phenomenon, and I really want to sort of explore them. So yes, go ahead.
Well, yeah, we're told that the Druids settled disputes about land, etc. As you mentioned, the Gauls used Greek characters, and there's very good evidence for this. I think there's a calendar, a calendar made out of beaten sheet bronze, which dates from, I think, either the 2nd century BC or the 2nd century AD, forgive me, from Gaul, and it's in Celtic language, but it's a calendar recording, the different phases of the moon, etc., auspicious and inauspicious days in Greek characters. And this lines up with what we're told from the ancient sources, which is that the Gauls were very careful astronomers. They tracked the movement of the stars and the moon, etc. Caesar actually tells us that they reckoned their calendar by, not by days, but by nights. And and the importance of the correct positioning of the moon, etc. And this stuff does seem to be backed up by the material evidence, and we do have the power of besides this leaning on writing, we are told again by Caesar that the Gauls themselves, the Druids themselves, when they were training, when they learned the Druidic lore, I suppose you would call it, it was learned entirely orally. Over a period of up to 20 years, you would learn verses. Caesar uses the word verse, so we might imagine songs or chants, etc. But they presided over all rituals and offerings, although there are references, I believe it's in Strabo, although forgive me if I'm wrong, to another group, which are called, I think, the Vates or the Vanes, who are augurers of another sort
I think these are sort of lesser augurers. I mean, I think you mentioned specifically the Druids had to train for 20 years. I think the Vanes had to train for 12. Yeah. I think the equivalent we have in sort of Irish and Gaelic culture is the great bardic tradition, the association with them being seers and them being poets.
And we're also told that the Druids practiced moral philosophy and natural philosophy. Yeah, it's really interesting stuff. And then, of course, we have the presiding over sacrifices. These sacrifices were not, I'm afraid, just of animals. There are extensive references to human sacrifice of all sorts. I think Lucan talks about not Lucan. Pliny or Strabo talks about the murdering, striking someone on the back of the head with a sword or an axe, and interpreting the future by the way that their body falls and the blood spurts out. And of course, we have the extensive archaeological evidence of a lot of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And we're also told, that they were fond of placing heads on top of spikes outside their houses,
the skull temples. And just sort of mentioning that, I mean, many other different methods. I mean, garrotting was one. Again, it sort of depended on what god you were focusing on. Drowning was one. And then, of course, within Caesar's own commentaries, we have the infamous Wicker Man. Do you want to expand upon that?
Well, yeah, I mean, the Wicker Man, it's what we know from the movies, I suppose. We are told that they would make giant figures out of brush and wicker, and they would throw someone into the center of it, and they would burn it, dancing around it. I think Strabo tells us they were dancing around it as well, and with a very potent image in your mind. And Caesar tells us that they would prefer. Ideally, you would get a criminal or somebody who has wronged the gods, etc. But if you couldn't, they would put up with innocence. But yeah, I mean, there's not so much archaeological evidence of the burning for obvious reasons. But we a lot of evidence of the importance of skulls. In the southeast of France, there's been a lot of archaeological evidence discovered to support that. But we do get the impression of a society that is ordered and somewhat advanced. Like I said, you know, they had the ability to settle disputes and to some extent a sort of internationalism. But the Aztecs, for example, right? It's clearly a very advanced civilization, but there's still a bunch of godless savages, you know, and they do horrific things.
The interesting thing, I don't really want to go into a tangent, but like the specific thing about the Aztecs is that they acquired sacrifices during this thing called the Flower Wars, where there was a great sort of orchestral sort of dramatic element to it, where they didn't focus on capturing their opponents, in this case the Tlaxcalans. Rather, they would capture their opponents and use them to sacrifice later. But when it comes to this specific, you know, the Druid sacrifice, as far as I'm aware, they tended to focus on sacrifice for essentially for criminals. Even in some cases, there would be innocent people who would be sacrificed. And I think we mentioned from the archaeology that some people did undergo human sacrifice willingly.
Yes, that is on record. The other thing that I would mention there, you mentioned garrotting and these things, and we are told by Lucan in his Pharsalia that, you know, some would be shot with arrows and some would be garrotted, etc. But there's very interesting evidence. Everybody knows the famous bog bodies, you know, and these bog bodies are occurring in a Celtic culture, you know, bogs and fens where because of the particular chemical solution within the bogs and the makeup of it, the bodies are preserved, the flesh is preserved pretty much permanently, you know. I mean, in some cases when these things have been discovered, people have, you know, called the police. I even believe one guy in England who had murdered his wife, the police were looking for his wife, found a bog body in the grounds of his garden, showed him the body, and he panicked and confessed to his wife's murder, even though it wasn't his wife. It was a 2,000-year-old Gaelic sacrificial victim.
Yes, I saw a BBC documentary on this. Yes. Yeah.
I mean, that must have been pretty galling, I guess you could say. But in the case of some of these bodies, I'm pretty sure Lindow Man is one of these examples. The body is not just being subjected to one of these things. It has been, you know, garrotted, and it has been, you know, struck on the back of the head, and it has been stabbed. And so we can see there's multiple things here going on. And some people are tended to think that this is the idea of the second death. You know, these people are such grievous sinners, they did something so terrible that they'll be killed like this. There are other camps. Some people, owing to the fact that inside the bellies of these bodies, because again they're very well preserved, you can even see the stomach contents. Occasionally, bizarre mixtures have been found of ergot and fungus, things that would probably get you very high. And so there might be a religious element here of them, you know, taking this before they are killed. Another interesting point is that in the case of Lindow Man, and certainly in the case of a number of the other bodies, most of these are male as well. Almost all of them are male. Some of the hands and the feet on these bodies do not show the kind of signs of hard work or hard labor that you would expect a 30 or 40 year old man in this period to have. And so, there's a couple of schools of thought on this. Some people think that these are sort of a third gender, if you will, you know, a sort of an androgynous sort of religious thing, which, not impossible. And some people think that it might have been a punishment for homosexuality or effeminacy. Tacitus tells us that that people would be put to death in this manner by the Germans as well. And again, we can draw comparisons between these traditions because they are interconnected. Tacitus tells us that it was done for people with unnatural lusts. So we do have that argument there as well. It's a very complicated thing, and there's different interpretations, but it's absolutely fascinating, but a lot of it is shrouded in mystery, and you have to try and parse together these examples. But definitely not a very pagan culture, shall we say.
Well, there's something I wanted to bring up. I mean, we mentioned human sacrifices going under it, willingly. Is it true that the Gauls had some form of metempsychosis or reincarnation? I mean, we mentioned their religion. One important aspect to mention about them, which we haven't, is that they were very much an animist culture, in that they held that, you know, certain creatures and, you know, life all around them had some sort of greater sacred spiritual meaning. In particular, they had great emphasis on the creature of the boar. How would you say that their thoughts on reincarnation were really integrated into their society? I mean, we mentioned already the aspect of human sacrifice and the dying of double death. I think that's, you know, again, something quite interesting, and something which, again, I wasn't aware of before doing my research on this.
There are a lot of it's a very interesting point. Caesar tells us that they believed that when they died they would be reborn in another body. Caesar tells us that they believed in reincarnation, and for this reason they were, you know, heedless of the fear of death, which is really interesting. And some scholars, I can't remember his name, but there was a guy writing in the 50s, a very good archaeologist, and he was trying to link this into Celtic ideas of time and triplication, you know, the importance of the spiral in Celtic art and symbolism, and the idea of time running in a circle, which from analysis of Celtic oral traditions and Celtic sagas, stuff like, you know, Cuchulainn from you know, Ireland, etc. There is this idea of the great cycle, but this idea of sort of great cyclical thinking can also be sort of linked to the broader Indo-European idea of, you know, I mean, in India it's called the Kalis, right? Evola writes about the Kali Yuga, you know, the ages, and so things sort of revolve and are eternally recurring. We see that in Norse mythology as well, you know.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of complex ideas about that, but they certainly did believe in reincarnation.
Wonderful. I think before, you know, we go on to the Gallic Wars, Marcus, is there anything you want to add on Gallic civilization?
Well, as the Latin man in the chat, I'm sort of more listening and learning myself, because it's not exactly my area of strength. But what I will say is that I did come across a YouTube video some years ago called Consequence of Cowardice, which did reflect upon, you might say, the, I don't know if mythos is the right word, but sort of this belief, this core belief of the Gauls, and I suppose of the Celts in a more wider sense, or certainly of this sort of Celtic Germanic sort of philosophical outlook on life and what motivated them to be brave. And if you look at what the ancient writers, whether it's Tacitus or, you know, whether the Greek writers are talking about the I think it was Aristotle who mentioned that sort of the Celts are the bravest of all the peoples, and they're almost yeah. reckless, because they don't fear the waves or the land or earthquakes or nothing. They're just absolutely fearless, actually void of fear. Mm. And to the sensibilities of a more sort of, in commas, sophisticated mind, that is reckless, or that is it's nonsensical to not fear things which should be feared. But that notion doesn't seem to enter the mind of the Gallic, Celtic, Germanic peoples. They are literally born warriors, and the religion that they have is obviously a massive part of that. And I don't know how else to elaborate on that, other than to say that I find extremely admirable that they were as motivated as they were, and they were as courageous as they were, because they were certainly gallant warriors.
Yeah, it kind of reminds one of the accounts that you read of, you know, British, French, and, you know, American trappers interacting with Native Americans, and they're just, you know, they're at an earlier, you know, more primeval stage of their development. And yeah, the men are just utterly fearless, and it's very shocking to a man who comes from a very developed society, you know, which, you know, Rome in the late Republic was in a lot of ways. And so people like Caesar are shocked by this. In terms of the point that you made about the Celtic religion being more animistic, certainly it's more animistic and less formal than, you know, the Roman or the Greek pantheon, etc. But there are established gods, you know, like Taranis that we've
yes,
talked
absolutely.
About.
Yes, absolutely. Again, it's more of a hybrid, and as we're going to mention,
it is a hybrid.
Romano-Gallic culture. That also, as we see throughout the Roman Empire, there is a hybrid form of a Roman religion inserted within the Gallic structure, you know, involving certain goddesses like that of Epona. But I think on that subject, I think we've pretty much summarized or given a brief summary for the listeners of pre-Roman Gallic civilization, even though pre-Roman, there was a lot of interaction there. And we've established that the Romans at this precise moment are in Narbonensis in the south of Gaul. Does anyone want to give like a brief summary or an account on the Gallic Wars? And again, I can, you know, I try and do it to the best of my ability, but considering, you know, both of you are classical scholars, you know, if you feel so inclined, do either of you want to sort of give an account of the Gallic Wars?
Well, I would just I would start off by saying that if you want to understand the reasons for the wars starting, Caesar had basically at this point made a name for himself in Rome. He had put on games for the people, etc. He was very advanced in his power, and he had managed to form the first triumvirate with Crassus and Pompey. You know, he had married his daughter to Pompey, and so the alliance had started. And with this alliance, he managed to gain a proconsulship. It was customary after your consulship, you would be granted a proconsulship. In other words, you would go off and govern somewhere for a year. And, you know, it's basically an opportunity to enrich yourself. It was the real, you know, prize that a lot of consuls were actually going after. But because Caesar had spent, you know, such wild amounts of money in his youth, you know, he was sort of a member of the Catilinarian faction, you know, the popular faction. Yeah. He was desperately in debt to Crassus as well, and so he needed to recoup his losses, and so he started the war in Gaul on the pretext of, I believe, the Helvetii had been aggravating one of the other tribes.
Could I add a bit of context to that? Because I think you bring up a very important point, which is the personal motivation of Caesar. And we'll get on to how that personal motivation, you know, really sort of mutates as this process continues. But I think it's important to note that the Romans did have a justified fear of migrating tribes. And in this case, we're talking about the Helvetii, and we'll eventually be talking about the Suebi, even though, again, the pretext for that was less, again, a direct attack on Rome. Mm-hmm. Rome would invariably, throughout the course of its history, form alliances with various, again, non-Roman peoples, almost to use it as a pretext for declaring war. With the Second Punic War, for example, the Romans would form an alliance with the city of Saguntum in Hispania in order to use that as a pretext to attack the Carthaginians. With the Gallic Wars, I believe that the Helvetii were threatening the Aedui, who were the main principal Roman allies in Gaul, and were operating around what we now consider to be the Burgundian region. So I think, combined with the fact that this is only 60 or so years after the Cimbrian Wars, there is a justified fear from the Romans about migrating tribes, and what we can see this as a preemptive strike against them.
Sorry, Marcus, after you.
No, I was just going to say, another important fact is we did touch on it very briefly with the discussion about Cisalpine Gaul, and another thing to sort of consider is that the conquest, the absorption, and the sort of gradual Romanization of Cisalpine Gaul is in part a consequence of Alia 390 BC. It is also a consequence of the Battle of Telamon, because when Rome basically gains the ascendancy in central Italy, it is the Samnites, it is the Etruscans, it's the Umbrians who more or less form a coalition, and they bring in these barbarians from the north. These are, you know, the Insubres, the Boii, other northern Celtic Italians or Celtic / Italian peoples. And the Romans defeat them pretty much in detail, the Battle of Telamon. And it's that resentment of the Roman absorption of these provinces that then motivate the Gauls to join Hannibal in the Second Punic War. And then I suppose the Romans have this broad hatred of Hannibal, the Carthaginians, and anybody who has helped them. So once the Romans do absorb these provinces in the north, there's a relief, because the Romans push the frontier to the Alps. They see it as a sort of this defensive boundary which they can defend. These enemies that were previously vehement opponents of Rome have been either absorbed or killed or enslaved or what have you. And then, like you say, then there's this situation comes up where you sort of fast forward, it's post the Cimbrian Wars, etc. You have sort of this personal situation with Caesar in terms of him leaving the consulship. He's acquired a massive debt to Crassus, among other people. He's also earned a lot of domestic enemies, because a lot of people, certainly from the more traditional side of Roman politics, abhorred the way he behaved, and particularly to his co-consul Bibulus, who he was regarded to have had his hooligans throw excrement at, amongst other things.
Yes, and then, I believe the consulship was called the consulship of Julius and Caesar by the people because Bibulus was so cucked.
That's exactly right. So, and I suppose, like, in some way, that's the mythos of Caesar almost starts with his lone consulship. And, you know, on one hand, he's wildly loved and, you know, appreciated by his supporters. And there's a part of Caesar that I think is actually a genuine patriot, but he definitely rubs off these domestic sort of old school elite, you might say, Rome, I mean, in the Senate,
him. Yeah, I mean, he's friends with, he's an associate of Catiline, right? Which are basically, I mean, you know, you must understand the populares, you know, the popular faction within Rome. There's sort of two sides to it in a way. The one side of it is, you know, the side of Catiline and Clodius and, you know, the theater, the raucous life, you know, and Caesar did have a hand in this, but Caesar was also related to Marius, who was, a champion of the populist faction as well. But, you know, we're told that Marius, once walked into a theater in Rome, and he was from, a small, you know, rustic town outside of Rome, somewhere in Italy to the north.
Marius was literally a novus homo. He was a new man.
Yeah, yeah. So he went into the theater and he was so disgusted by what he saw that he just got up and left. In Caesar, we see sort of a dance between these two populist factions. He's trying to sort of accommodate both, if you will. And this is one of the big draws for Caesar from the Gallic Wars, because by winning such victories over the northern barbarians, he can then attach himself even more fully in the people's mind with Marius, you know, who defended Rome from, you know, during the Cimbrian War.
Exactly. And, right.
Yeah.
And also another thing to attach to that, and I think sometimes this is forgotten in the wash of this discussion, is that if we rewind ourselves to when Caesar enters adulthood, or he's on the cusp of adulthood, that is when Marius and the populace are first crushed by Sulla. And Caesar actually quite narrowly survives the proscriptions.
Yeah.
And Sulla does bring a lot of Marius' supporters either to death or has them punitively punished by confiscations of property and what have you. Caesar ends up enlisting in the army, and that's the famous story of, you know, him being captured by the pirates and having them crucified and, you know, mocking them for not understanding his poetry and all that. And Caesar develops this sort of cunning, very cunning streak early, and it sort of sticks with him his entire life, but it starts at an early point in time, and sort of all these various factors that we've been talking about in the last 5 minutes all coalesce to him being proconsul of the three provinces, you know, the two Gauls and Illyricum, and then the Helvetii come into the picture. So I guess that's the start point of what we're going to talk about now.
Yes, and I think that's an absolute beautiful summary from the both of you, the coalescing of all these factors, not only of Roman history, but of Caesar's personal history. So I think we can start from that and move on to the actual course of the war. Do either of you sort of want to start off?
I'll let Marcus go. After you, Marcus.
Oh, okay. Well, Helvetii cross, what river is it? I actually just have gone blank. But they basically cross into what's modern day Switzerland, I believe, and they do threaten the Roman allies, the Gallic allies.
Is it the Rhone?
Yes. Well, I think it's important to note that Helvetii is basically almost like the neoclassical interpretation of the nation of Switzerland. When we have the Napoleonic period, it's renamed as the Helvetian Republic, even though after this period, the Romans, I think, would rename this province to be Rieti and Noricum. But yes, I think it was, I can't remember if it was crossing of the Rhone, but, you know, entering into the Savoy the modern-day Savoy region, definitely,
We're told that there was pressure on them from the Germans. The Germans were trying to cross over the Rhine, and so they were pressured to leave elsewhere, I believe.
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, between the battles of the Arar and Bibracte, Caesar engages the Helvetii, puts them into flight, and you sort of already very early in his military career begin to see elements of his genius and the way that he fights. And he continues that methodology and improves upon it all the way through the Gallic Wars. Then it's with that methodology embedded into, you know, himself firstly, his sub-commanders and his fighting men broadly, carries that through the Civil War. And even though Caesar does suffer some setbacks in his career, he's, you know, inarguably one of the greatest generals of antiquity and arguably of all history. And it does start with humble beginnings against those two battles against the Helvetii, who were sort of more migrating into this territory, threatening the Roman border, threatening the Aedui, who are the sort of Roman Gallic satellite allies in the area. And then sort of the war does end up taking, how can I sort of explain this? It sort of takes on a life of its own, and a whole bunch of circumstances come into play, whether it's the interaction with the Suevi or the Sequani. The legions basically end up moving almost by happenstance on one hand and Caesar's ambition on the other hand, and move deeper and deeper into Gaul.
Yeah, certainly. And we also see, as you say, we see things change on the fly. I don't think that when Caesar was going in, he had the idea of conquering all of Gaul, right? I don't think that's what was going on there. But it's arguable. It's arguable. I mean, he was certainly a very ambitious man. But we do see, for example, I believe it's in 54, the triumvirate is still going. It's still in power. And we have Pompey and Crassus are both lined up, you know, and they have a consul. It's their consulship. They're both the consuls. And Caesar is in Gaul at this time. And Caesar maintains a base in sort of Cisalpine Gaul, I believe, a sort of base of operations from which, you know, he can keep track of what's going on in Rome, etc. And even though he's allied with Crassus and Pompey, he knows that he needs to keep his hand in, so to speak. He needs to keep his name around in Rome, and he doesn't want to be eclipsed by these two men whilst he's off fighting. And so what does he do? It's in this year that he decides, I'm going to invade Britain. He invades Britain, and he has his lightning campaign across the Rhine, you know, where the bridge is built, and they're over for like 18 days, I believe. And, you know, he wins some crushing victories in Germany. In Britain, he makes slight inroads, but really he doesn't bring enough men. It's more of a exploratory, you know, an expedition, if you will. But it causes an absolute sensation in Rome. I mean, you must understand that Gaul was relatively well known, but Britain was still, you know, almost a place of myth to the Romans. I mean, it wasn't really known what was there. I mean, you had Ptolemy the Navigator, I think, you know, in like, God, like the 3rd century, he had circumnavigated some of it, but it was pretty much totally unknown. And so... Yeah. For Caesar to cross over here and then cross over the Rhine, which had also never been done before, it caused an absolute sensation in Rome, and the Senate was under so much pressure that they decreed him 15 days of thanksgiving, which was also unprecedented. And so, yeah, we see Caesar responding to the political situation in Rome, and in a sense, the entire conquest of Gaul is a PR project for Caesar.
Well, yes, I think there's an underlying sort of current which we need to mention, which is Caesar's underlying ambition. I mean, we're talking about the pretext of the war. Of course, the original pretext was the Helvetii threatening the Aedui. And of course, when after he defeats the Helvetii, the next great threat comes from the Suebi and the Germanic king Ariovistus. And again, they are collaborating, not just against the Aedui, but against the Romans, using the Sequani and the Arverni, who will become very significant later on, as Gallic allies against the Romans. And I think, you know, that there's still a pretext there, that they are still protecting the allies of Rome. But then you have Caesar going into the Belgae regions, which is the north. Basically, he's perusing from the Savoy, you know, up through Alsace along the west bank of the Rhine. And then, of course, as we mentioned, he does cross it. But, you know, what was the pretext really for invading Britain at this point? I think there was a flimsy pretext about the Britons being tentatively involved in supplying weapons to the Gallic enemies and the German enemies. So the pretext becomes weaker and weaker and weaker and weaker. So do you think there was ever a moment where Caesar basically decided that I'm going to conquer all of Gaul? Or because it does seem, again, that his ambition was getting greater and greater and greater with the number of conquests, you know, first the Helvetii, then the Suebi, then the Belgae.
I think it's almost a case of inertia of the campaign, and inertia in a couple of ways. One, I think Caesar actually in some ways proves to himself just how good a commander he becomes from battle to battle. And also he learns the capabilities of his subordinates, be it, you know, Titus Labienus, who would obviously famously later defect to the senatorial side during the Civil War, but yeah. of, you know, the likes of Marcus Antonius and Crassus' son, who actually famously serves under him, who unfortunately dies at Bella
Carhaix later. And Cicero's brother Quintus also serves under Caesar. And correct. Caesar actually, after the battle, Quintus is ambushed and besieged in his camp with his men, a detachment of by the Nervii or the Nervii. And so we see he acquits himself very well. He manages to get a dispatch off to Caesar, and Caesar rushes as soon as he can to relieve Quintus. And Caesar, in his commentaries, actually has, you know, nothing but praise for Quintus, Cicero's brother. And of course, this is very interesting because I believe this happened in 54 BC, and at this time Cicero had, you know, been agitating against the triumvirate. But at this point, he had been decidedly cowed, and he had made a speech in the Senate talking about how you know, the names of all the nations that Caesar is conquering resound in my ears. And so we could if you take the argument that the commentaries were published and sent to Rome annually, as opposed to, you know, a block at the end of the conquest, etc. I personally think it's more likely that it's an annual publication. We can see Caesar throwing a bone to Cicero, and, you know, being like, look, okay, you be nice to me, I'll be nice to you, you know.
And it's so, also it's
really interesting.
And also the commentaries, if they go to Rome annually or whatever time basis it is also sort of meat for the, you know, for the street cries and the heralds, you know, to basically curry favor with the populace. Who, I mean, I think once Caesar became famous, I think he was quite held in dearly to the hearts of most Roman citizens. And that would be proven at his funeral at the end of his life. I mean, it was... with the news, I mean, I don't want to jump too far ahead, but basically when he was assassinated, essentially the vast majority of the Roman public were saddened by it. But I just want to hark back to the campaign just for a second. What we also see in Caesar is this this genius, and I can't remember, it was definitely against the Suevi, and I can't remember what battle was they actually fought against the Suevi, but there's an instance where the German king will meet him only if he brings a bodyguard, but he knows the Romans aren't good horsemen. So he basically has his 10th Legion. For those who don't know, his 10th Legion, watch his favorite.
Oh, sorry, just for clarification, is this the Battle of Vesontio?
Thank you, Vesontio. I think that's, I'm pretty sure that's right. And he meets the German king with his 10th Legion mounted on horseback, which is not what they were trained to do. But he's got his best fighters with him, and the German leader is sort of flummoxed at the fact that Caesar thought of this on the fly. And there are so many instances where Caesar just comes up with, you know, ideas, or will, like, build a bridge somewhere, or build a fortress in the middle of a hill somewhere in a battlefield just to throw off the enemy. And this sort of innate the discipline builds within Caesar in his Gallic campaigns. And sort of, I think there's a part of him that realizes, as he sort of, if I may use the term, power level increases, you know, he realizes he can accomplish more.
Yeah, certainly. With regards to his improvisation, we do see this very early on in the commentaries with the Helvetii, when they're demanding or requesting passage down through the Rhone Valley. Caesar says, "Well, let me deliberate, you know, let me think, and come back in, you know," I think he gives them like 3 days, no, like a week or something like this. And so they leave, they go off, Orgetorix, his ambassadors leave, and Caesar immediately instructs his legions to build an 8-foot tall wood and earth wall stretching the entire length of the valley.
Exactly.
And they come back and Caesar
just can't cross it.
It is against the honor of the Roman people for you to be able to cross. And so we just see this remarkable engineering know-how from the get-go. I mean, we even see that before he even gets to Gaul in Rome, during his aedileship, he designs machines for his games, and he designs big, huge temporary plazas in the Comitium and the Forum to display all sorts of artifacts, etc., that he designed himself. He designed these piazzas. So clearly, a dab hand when it comes to engineering and architecture from a very early age. Ludicrously intelligent, and his men were You know, there's been no finer army in history. The things that they were capable of. I mean, they built the bridge across the Rhine so quickly that when they did it, the tribes on the other side just surrendered immediately.
They
were just so shocked by what they had seen.
It was you might say classical shock and awe in some ways. You know, like these enemies were just daunted by Roman capability, and then Caesar could write home and boast about it.
Yeah, and then I would say if we're talking about a moment where Caesar realizes the true potential here and realizes that he wants to conquer all of Gaul, I would say it's when he finally defeated the Nervii, because it was a very close run thing. He almost lost, but he ended up taking the field himself, grabbing a shield and taking the field himself until the 10th legion relieved them. But I would say after that, and after the submission of all of the tribes who took part in that, I think that's also when people realized he could do something very,
but
very
also I think you mentioned we were all talking geographically about the eastern side of what would later become the Roman province or series of Roman provinces of Gaul. Before he goes to Britain, he also subjugates, as we mentioned, the Veneti, and you know, also using his major military sort of innovations to be able to outclass them at their own navy, despite again the Romans didn't have any Atlantic faring ships. But you mentioned the conquest of Britain, you know, despite it being a PR success, very similar to Napoleon's conquest of Egypt, it didn't really leave any sort of lasting sort of legacy of conquest, and the Roman conquest would like come later under the reign of Emperor Claudius. And I think in terms of the actual effects on Gaul, you could say that this is a period of disaster for Caesar. So we're talking about 55 BC, 54 BC.
Yes,
55.
He leaves, and then there's a rebellion amongst because he's forcing the Gauls to put up.
It's more than that. On the one hand, you have the fact that again Caesar lost a lot of men, especially in the original amphibious attack against amphibious invasion of Britain. But the fact that when he comes back, his position in Rome is also undermined. You have Crassus, who dies the Battle of Carrhae, I think it's in 54 or 53, against the Parthians. And you have Julia, who is Julius Caesar's wife, and the daughter, and the wife of Pompey Magnus. And she dies, I think, in 55. And so that's that familial tie between Pompey and Caesar is broken. The triumvirate really sort of begins to collapse at this point. And you mentioned the unrest in Gaul. And I think this is a time to really bring this conversation back to how this is significant for in terms of trying to come up with a Gallic identity, trying to deconstruct a Gallic identity. First of all, we have the revolt of Ambiorix. But more significantly, you mentioned earlier, Columba, about the special significance of the Carnute region, how that this was some sort of despite the fact that Gaelic civilization was very much decentralized among these tribal lines, and then you had certain republics like the Aedui, all the Druids in particular would come together in the sacred region of the Carnute, which would be basically the hub of all of Gaul, and this would be where the rebellion of Vercingetorix begins, where you have the massacre of various Roman merchants during in the year 53. And what we see from 53 to 550 is, you could almost say, it's the beginning of a pan-Gallic consciousness. And had, you know, Vercingetorix, for example, been able to win the Battle of Alesia, I mean, he'd already won the Battle of, if I remember correctly, the Battle of Gergovia, against Julius Caesar and defeated him. Had this been accelerated, and had he been able to manufacture the Druids, and this is really significant, the Druids as part of an international sort of Gallic elite, and use that as the basis of his power, he could have elevated himself. And again, he comes from the powerful Arverni tribe, which is in the modern region of Auvergne, which is, you know, where the city of Clermont-Ferrand is. He could have positioned himself as some sort of Gallic high king. So really, the conquest of Caesar and its potential undoing at the result of, you know, the undoing of the triumvirate, and his, you could almost say, his wobbly campaign in Britain could have resulted in the unification of Gaul.
Well, I mean, Caesar, he takes risks, right? And they always pay off. But I mean, that's how he gets to where he is. It's constant risks, and the stakes get ever higher. But in terms of the Carnutes and their relationship, that area's relationship later on, we do see, if my geography stands, just north of the land of the Carnutes, you have the land of the Rimae. and the Rimae later on, they have their major settlement. I can't remember the original name, but the Romans seem to have had a practice where when enough Romanization went on in Gaul in the later, you know, the 3rd and 4th centuries AD, the cities would be renamed after the people. And so the city of the Rimae eventually became Rim, which has obviously... Yeah. Titanic importance for the history of the French people and the French kingship, etc. So that whole area, that sort of just north central.
Yes, I just for some context, Alesia is in Burgundy and Reims is in the Champagne region of France. So we're talking, you know, east of Paris, east of the Île-de-France region, the sort of heartlands of France.
And we see, of course, the same thing happen. I mean, Paris was named after the Parisii. But then in the south, with the more Greek settlements, we don't see this new renaming convention. But yeah, that whole area was considered sacred and very, very meaningful and a sort of a rallying point, if you will. But when you talk about Wergin Cethrix and, you know, the establishment of a pan-Gallic identity, yes, certainly that is true. And of course, before the great uprising under Wergin Cethrix, Caesar had declared all of Gaul a province. So this is another thing, you know, that they're realizing that this is their last chance. But we do see classic signs of, you know, unification and this idea of a greater Gallic state. I mean, Wergin Cethrix has coins minted, right? I mean, coins had actually been minted in Gaul for a long time, for hundreds of years, but we see these coins minted, you know, much more widely than they had been before.
Yes.
And so we see this attempt of creating this Gaul, this unified Gaul against Caesar, and of course it's Caesar's greatest challenge, I would argue. I mean, you know, everybody knows about the Battle of Alesia, but I think it is almost unbelievable.
Yes, I think for the sake of this conversation, I mean, we've already mentioned Caesar's defeat at Gergovia, but to really understand how significant Alesia was and how the odds were stacked against Caesar, does anyone want to explain just quickly the Battle of Alesia?
So we have an oppidum, right, Alesia, and Wergin Cethrix is holed up inside with his army. The estimates are around, you know, Caesar tells us something like 90,000, but I reckon probably about 50,000 men, maybe 60,000. And Caesar with about, I think, 40,000 legionaries and then maybe 15,000 auxiliaries is besieging Alesia. But Wergin Cethrix manages to get messengers out, riders out, who ride out. And of course, Caesar builds a circumvallation, you know, a giant wall around the city to besiege the city, and when these riders are sent out to summon all of the Gallic tribes to come and aid Wergin Cethrix and his army, Caesar tells us that something like, you know, 150,000, 200,000 Gauls came to aid them, and Caesar knew that they would be there relatively soon, and so he orders his legions to build another wall around the wall that he has built and positions his men within. And so, I mean, this wall didn't go all the way around because there were mountains and cliffs. And so in all the gaps between the inaccessible mountains and cliffs, he built this massive wall, even diverted a river to flood one portion of it, laid spikes, towers, multiple ditches.
We've lost Columba for a bit.
I can continue. I'll continue. I don't mind.
Just in terms of the significance, I can't go into as much detail regarding the Battle of Alesia as Columba can. Marcus, could you sort of follow on from the points that Columba was bringing up?
Yeah, sure. You know, for the sake of the audience, for those who don't know about it, I mean, the scale of the fortifications weren't slight either. I mean, you take into account that 25 miles of fortification were constructed in less than a month. Most of it done in the first 2 weeks of that month. And, you know, there were, I think, approximately 20 towers on each, the circumvallation and the contravallation. And to consider that the Romans themselves were quite deep in enemy territory, had just suffered, you know, definitely a bloody nose, if not an outright defeat at the hands of Wergin Cethrix at Gergovia. And like you say, there's sort of this sort of, at the very end of the story, there's this sort of efflorescence of Gallic identity and sort of a great sort of maybe patriotic's not the right word, but for the sake of the discussion, you know, like this identity, the Gauls need to sort of band together and kick out an invader and you know, fight as brothers in arms. And even though Caesar obviously inflates the figure of both certainly the relieving army, but also possibly of Vercingetorix's army as well in the oppidum, I mean, the odds are so dramatically against Caesar, and yet he not only finds a way to win. Caesar very often himself in the course of the Battle of Alesia is leading sorties either at the gate of his walls or beyond the walls himself. And you hear, no matter which author writes a book about it, never mind Caesar's own commentaries, but even historians afterwards writing about it, you always hear like Caesar scraping together reserves and a cohort here and a couple of, you know, centuries here and the wounded that can still walk and, you know, throwing together units to, you know, just to plug gaps in the wall and to keep the Gauls back. Meanwhile, he keeps his Germanic cavalry reserve. You got to think the sheer amount of will and self-discipline and steel to keep your best mobile units in reserve for days and then to use them just as the Gallic relief army gets tired.
Hey, can you guys hear me?
Plumber? Yes, you're back.
Yes, hello? There we go.
Hello?
No, no, hello? Hello?
No, no, you're there. You're back.
Am, can you hear me?
I can.
Plumber, come on.
I don't think no? You can hear me.
Okay.
I'm terribly confused.
Okay, is it just me who can't hear him?
I think so.
I can hear you now. I can hear you now.
No, we got you, mate.
Okay, there we go. Continue, guys.
Yeah, and it's just this monumental undertaking. And, you know, they say, you know, guys of our ilk could, you know, talk black and blue, you know, for days on end about who the best commander is in history and blah, blah, blah. But Alesia, probably along with the Sabis and Pharsalus, is, you know, Caesar's hour. And the victory he pulls off at Alesia is nothing short of astonishing. When you consider all the conditions and all the circumstances around it and the sheer ingenuity, the sheer strength of character, his actual personal courage as well to surmount the challenges he faces at Alesia is I don't have words. It's just immense in a scale.
And also, I mean, by this point, his army had been trained and honed to the point where it was pretty much, I mean, the core legions were... I mean, probably the best soldiers in the world at that point, you know. I don't think it's any exaggeration to say that. And yeah, it's just, it's, we wonder how he managed to get the resources together to do this, how you're managing to gather resources and manage to keep an army that outnumbers your own cooped up inside a wall, etc., and feed your men. It is pretty stunning. And then, of course, the Senate decrees, I think, 20 days of thanksgiving for Caesar. And you know, the triumph that he has when he returns is, well, no, he doesn't have the triumph, of course. That's when you get the Rubicon. But I think It at that point, Caesar realized that he could do pretty much anything he wanted.
If anyone's interested, and if I may, AM, I just want to quickly, just as a reflection, wheel back to the Battle of the River Sabis. There's actually an instance where I'm pretty sure it's the 7th Legion on the right wing of the battlefield. In the vast majority of its cohorts, and in some of its cohorts, it loses all of its centurions. And its senior centurion, a man by the name of Baculus, is so wounded by major and minor wounds, he can't hold his weapon or stand up. And the 7th Legion doesn't yield. It doesn't collapse. It doesn't retreat.
Yeah.
And that is the kind of force that Caesar has built, and it's the kind of, you might say, absolutely unwavering loyalty and discipline that his army has built and would quite literally follow Caesar into Hades, you know, not to use an expression from the show, but they would.
I mean, because the centurions were you know, the gruff sergeants, if you will, of the Roman army, and they carried vine staffs, and which they would just, you know, whip the legionaries with. And so their job was to keep order in the ranks, basically, and to keep discipline. And in such a desperate situation as that, all the forces that are meant to keep order, the centurions, are gone. And for his men to keep in good order and not panic, it demonstrates their individual discipline, but also just the trust that they had in Caesar. But this point, sorry, I was just gonna say, at this point, sorry, any sort of possibility of rebellion seems to be crushed permanently for, you know, about a century before you get anything major again. It's a crippling defeat for the Gauls.
Well, most significantly than that, yeah. I think there are two things I really want to bring on, because as much as, you know, it's tempting to make this a continuation of Caesar's story, really the story of Caesar sort of has to end here for the conversation at the end of the conclusion of the Gallic Wars. I think there are two things I want to mention. One is, of course, Vercingetorix personally surrenders to Caesar at this point. And I'll be quite interested, you know, first of all, to hear, you know, what your thoughts are on why he did that. Second question is, what was the, not only just the material effect, but the human cost to Gaul and Gallic civilization as result of the conquest? So this is directed towards both of you, if you want to contribute.
Well, I mean, in terms of the amount of blood and treasure, I mean, Caesar tells us that an absurd number of slaves were taken to Rome, somewhere in the ballpark of a million Gallic slaves were taken to Rome during and immediately after this. You know, just a vast, and then treasure and silver and gold, and so things were totally drained, and any possibility of resistance seems to have been crushed. In terms of why Vercingetorix surrendered, I think just perhaps the trauma of the situation. Everybody understood that this was it, you know, and I think just the vast slaughter that occurred and how outnumbered Caesar was, I think they just gave up. I think they really did, which in itself is a testament to the situation. But I mean, after this we see Gaul just totally taken over by the Romans, and the colonization process begins apace. You know, they begin to lay down roads and infrastructure and consolidate their conquest, and there's remarkably little major resistance for a long time, which tells you how crushed they were. And we see the Romans begin to advance further. Like you said, they conquered Britain later on, of course, during Claudius. But under Augustus, major inroads were made into Germany. You had the beginning of the Limes or the Limes in Germany, and Gaul has the opportunity to truly begin to civilize or Romanize and becomes far more wealthy, and there's a lot of urbanization, and we see the establishment of large towns and cities like Lugdunum, which becomes, you know, the center of the three Gauls. There's a temple there to Augustan peace, etc., and the Concordia of the three Gauls. So yeah, we see this is the basis for the establishment of all of that.
Yes, and just to add a little bit of context, of course, the three Gauls you're talking to are Gallia Aquitania, Gallia Belgica, and Gallia Lugdunensis. In terms of, I really want to sort of understand this Romanization process. From my understanding, the Romanization process had even begun before the conquest, and this is the relationship that the various Celtic elite had with the Roman culture, and how as a result of this Romanization process they themselves had become Romanized, and they would, you know, send their children off to Rome, they would receive Roman education, they would learn Latin, and as a result you have a Latin Gallic elite culture, which is, you know, essentially propagating the post-conquest situation. However, you have a more or less, you know, vast majority of the population, the non-urbanized population, the rural population, who are still, you know, speaking Gallic, who, you know, aren't really that exposed to Latin, even though we have the explosion of the villa system throughout the entirety of the empire. I think that there are some interesting cases in terms of this Romanization process. When I was doing my research, I discovered one Jucius Licinus, who was a procurator for Augustus in Gaul, who had started off his career as a slave as a result of the Gallic Wars, who would rise through the ranks and basically become from a Gallic slave, who would become a freedman, and then he would become the Gallic version of a Crassus, basically, you know, seizing vast amounts of money and resources from the Gauls, you know, sending it back to Rome, but in most cases, you know, appropriating himself. And the official excuse he would give to Augustus when there was, you know, a fear that this would set off a revolt was that he was preemptively preventing a revolt by impoverishing the Gauls.
But, you know, yeah, that argument was literally made. Yeah. And it seems to work as well, which is the wonderful part. But I mean, freedmen were commonly sort of used as creatures of emperors, you know, to do dirty work, etc. But the Romanization process had begun, and Caesar tells us that there was a crushingly sharp divide between the Gallic aristocracy and the commoners. You know, the commoners were treated pretty much like slaves; they had absolutely no say in any form of administration. And so, yeah, I think when we're talking about Romanized Gauls and, you know, Gallia Togata and, like, you know, toga wearing Gauls, these are the aristocrats who are now moving within Roman circles. I think that's definitely a safe bet to say. And we do have interchange and interaction for a long time. I mean, Caesar tried to introduce Gallic senators, right? I mean, this was one of the things that led to his fall, actually.
Yeah.
The Senate just seemed to be totally Italian in its identity, I guess we could say. I mean, even into the Antonine period, you know, in the third century or the second century.
Well, that's something I want to
Italian.
There's something I want to ask. Is it true that Antoninus Pius was originally part of a family which was part of Gallic aristocracy?
Yes, I think that is true. I lean towards that being true. But this is the thing, though. There is a separation between an attention between the emperors and the senatorial aristocracy.
That does
persist all the way up. And again, like, even in the Antonine period, the Senate, as far as we can tell, was at least three quarters made up of Italians. We also see the emperors are, of course, a populist check on this, and the idea of the emperor is, and Caesar's conception was, you know, a broader conception of Romanitas, as we've talked about. You know, we wanted to,
I think, in terms of Gaul, I think in Gaul in particular, of course, we would see that manifested through the constitution of the Antonine constitution in 212, which would give, you know, all Roman citizens citizenship, and would really facilitate that process of Romanizing Gaul. But there's something specific I want to mention. We mentioned the significance of the Carnuti region. We mentioned the significance of the Druids. On our stream, if you want to check out on this channel, Columba and I had a discussion regarding Julian the Apostate and the various, you know, pagan religious policies of the empire in terms of trying to create localized, you know, syncretic religious cults to try and, you know, ingratiate local deities, local, you know, pagan worship within the comprehensive system under the purview of the Pontifex Maximus, who also happened to be the princeps. Something I really want to go into is why, you know, particularly during the early Roman period and during the reign of Emperor Claudius, etc., we have such a persecution of the Druids. In terms of, you know, just trying to give my own assessment, from Julius Caesar himself, I think we have this account that the Druids were a process of Gallic separatism. And I think very much, you know, we see again and again the accounts is that the Romans will hark on the human sacrifice aspect and this attempt to try and civilize Gaul. You know, in the same breath, they are revered by the Romans for their breadth of learning, but also, you know, feared for their practice of human sacrifice. So you can say, you know, ostensibly the pretext was human sacrifice, but I think there was a deep political undercurrent, which was, again, seeing Druids as a fundamentally subversive force within Gallic society and a source of potential rebellions. Do you think that's an accurate assessment?
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting. I do think on the one hand, if we look at, I believe Cicero in his fourth Catilinarian speech, a speech to the Senate, he speaks about, and this is actually he's debating with Caesar about, you know, what to do with the Catilinarian conspirators. He says to the Senate, and we all know conscript fathers, that these tales our forefathers told of the terrors that await the wicked after death, in fact, were created to make the condemned fear death. And so he's making this argument, basically trying to leaning towards Caesar's argument to grant clemency. But the point is that if the Senate, we do see respect for new humanist and skeptical interpretations of older Roman mythological ideas amongst the senatorial aristocracy. I mean, we also see them abhor things like human sacrifice, etc. Caesar, on the other hand, seems to have played into it. I mean, there was almost, Caesar was, of course, the Pontifex Maximus, and he was the first Pontifex Maximus to be elected to the post for quite a long time. Usually they were co-opted in by other aristocrats, but there was a popular election which he won. And we see him try and revive bizarre ancient religious traditions, like, you know, he wants to suspend this man called Rabirius from a withered tree until he dies. He wants to and he sticks some heads on spikes outside of his priestly home in the Forum. So we can see, on the one hand, amongst the aristocrats there was this skepticism towards these barbarous practices, but on the other hand, people like Caesar and the populists kind of loved them. So I would put it down to a cynical move. But then again, in the imperial period, we see the more extreme tendencies or towards these sorts of bizarre things in the populist factions sort of, at least to some extent, fade away. There's a rapprochement with the older republican ideals, at least on the face of things. So I don't know. I think the condemnation of barbarous practices could have been a factor. But certainly, I mentioned the sort of mediating role that the Druids played as a sort of international force, an international power that could cause unified action. And I do think that's the most important thing here. The Roman policy towards the Druids, this does seem to be one of just relentless persecution and domination. Caesar tells us that the base of Druidic learning was in Britain. Even the Druids in Gaul would go to Britain to learn, which again gives you this idea of this sort of internationalism. And Tacitus tells us that the final destruction of the Druids took place around 70, I believe, under his stepfather Agricola, and he draws on these barbarous practices. He describes the legionaries finding, you know, stone altars drenched with the blood of sacrificial victims, etc. So
yes, yeah. trying to find a pretext for this. You mentioned the year 70. I can't help but feel that you mentioned again this connection, this, you know, Brythonic Gallic connection, and, you know, how the Druids, of course, you know, it did exist in Britain as well and were very prominent. Whether the pretext for, you know, getting rid of Druids throughout the empire was the fact that Britain had been recently absorbed into the empire during the reign of the Emperor Claudius, and you had the revolt of Boudica and the Iceni, and whether that had been spurred on by the Druids, and the Romans were fearing that this could lead to similar uprisings throughout the Gallic elements of the empire.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a possibility as well. I mean, again, we see, I believe, under the Roman colonization, a new Pan-Gallic council was established under the Roman authority, and I suppose we could argue in some sense that this is also an act intended to undermine the traditional forms of internationalism that existed with the Druids and in the land of the Carnutes, etc. So I do think that that's an argument there, yeah.
Well, there's something sort of more than that. It's we mentioned the very nature of the Druids, how they are the preservers of this great oral tradition and this great religious tradition. Could it simply be, as we mentioned, that the Romans were able to co-opt much of the Gallic nobility into the system? Could it simply be a case that the Druids, as a political caste, as you know, a potential threat to the Romans, couldn't be co-opted into the system?
Well, yeah, I mean, perhaps the Druids were far more resistant to, you know, the Roman syncretic tradition and, you know, the imperial cult, things like this. I mean, we are told again by Caesar that the Druids and the Caesar calls them the equites, but essentially, yeah, the aristocrats, the knights, yeah, the warrior nobility, they are two very distinct blocks. I think perhaps the Druids would have been harder to appropriate and co-opt.
Marcus, do you have anything to say on this?
I think we have a bit of an intersection of things occurring here on the religious aspect, because sort of Rome has this almost sort of bipolar attitude to the subject, where if you look at the way the Romans, obviously as the empire expanded and incorporated a wider range of peoples into the polity of Rome, into the nation, I suppose, of Rome, the Empire of Rome. It was, by and large, I suppose, so long as people rendered unto Caesar what, you know, to Caesar, you know, people could follow gods such as, you know, quite famously, the cult of Sol Invictus and Mithras, and there was not much opposition. In fact, in some areas of society, quite a rapid uptake of those cults, and there was rarely an objection from the Romans. But I think in the case of the Celts, or certainly the Gauls, you have this this class of druids who are simply, I don't know if unassailable is the right word, but would be, they could not be released from their ancestral traditions. And I think on a raw political scale, the druids would always be the standard by which the Celtic Gallic people could always rally around. And the Romans, having had this very profound danger on their borders for centuries in the form of the Gallic and Celtic peoples, just would not, I don't think they could ever live with having these druids simply out in the wild, so to speak, being a threat to Rome, no matter how small or minute that threat might perceivably be. And the only way the Romans could put it to bed was essentially the destruction of the druids, as sort of gruesome as that might sound. I think the Romans were troubled by them as an entity and were concerned that, you know, no matter how small the risk might be, they would always be this sort of standard by which the Celtic Gallic people could always rally around, and they would always carry their traditions.
I think that's a very interesting point. You know, again, regarding the nature of Rome and how it could synthesize with this culture. I think in terms of the chronology, sort of to move on a bit. Columbus sort of ended at the reign of Augustus. Of course, the German the expansion of the Roman Empire into Germany is put to bed by the Battle of Teutoburg Forest. Even though we have the retribution of Germanicus, the project to expand Rome up to the Elbe is halted, and we of course have the Macromanni Wars with Marcus Aurelius. But again, that attempt to expand into Germania, into what we now know as Bohemia, failed as well. But however, the province of Gaul did include, you know, certain German aspects. Of course, on the west bank of the Rhine, we have the province of Germania Inferior. At a certain point throughout the second and third centuries, we also have the Agri Decumates, which are the series of fort regions in what is now Swabia, which linked the Rhine River with the Danube River, basically forming the northern frontier of Rome. However, there's something quite interesting that happens during the crisis of the third century, which is that Gallienus is defeated, and you have the usurpation, or rather the secession of the Gallic Empire under the Batavian general Postumus. Do you think the Gallic Empire is, you know, worth mentioning in terms of any sort of distinct culture or any sort of legitimacy other than that of Rome, just as a project? Because it was an empire, basically like a rump state of Rome cusp that seceded from it, which did form over the provinces of Gaul and of Britannia.
Well, I do believe that the term Imperium Galliarum, you know, the Gallic Empire, was used before or during the revolt of, I believe, Vindex. Which was around, you know, sort of what, 50, 60 AD. And so there was, they were drawing on this older tradition, and perhaps they were drawing all the way back to where King Getrix, you know, coins were minted, but it did. By this point, it was so Romanized that the rulers of this state were very Romano Gallic aristocrats, and so in fact, I mean, in the case of the revolt that happened earlier, at the same time you had serious problems in Rome with Nero, and I believe that it was Julius Civil. Vindex. I believe he was actually part of a conspiracy in the 50s to on behalf of Nero's mother Agrippina to try and get rid of Nero. So we would argue that that earlier revolt that happened there is not some resurgence of Gallic nationalism or whatever, and rather it is a power play within the empire, somebody trying to gain power within the empire, in the tradition of what we see in the German legions, etc. In terms of the later proper Gallic Empire, again, same problem. So I'd say both of these things are inescapably influenced by Rome.
So would you say that Postumus and then later Tetricus, who would be defeated by Aurelian, the Gallic Empire was simply a power base for which to conquer the rest of the Roman Empire, or potentially press a claim to the Imperium of Rome. It wasn't this genuine attempt to secede and create this new Romano-Gallic sovereign empire.
Well, I think certainly the Gallic part did come into it, right? Just judging by how the thing was split. I mean, it was Britain, Spain, and France essentially, and so there might be this sort of this sense of unity amongst these aristocratic groups, etc. A history of interaction that comes into it, but I think really it was just real politic power plays in the crisis of the third century. You'll take whatever territory you can get. It's a total free for all. In the East, perhaps in the Palmyrene Empire, you could argue that there's more of a resurgence of the ancient Eastern cultures. You have Zenobia take charge, who does not seem to have been as Romanized, etc.
Well, in that particular case, I'll just quickly make this point, Marcus. Ptolemaic Egypt comes to mind, this, revival of the ancient Greek East, because again, the nature of Roman expansion in the East is that they basically, after conquering the Greek systems, they basically inherited the great kingdoms of the Diadochi. And as we know, with the Byzantine Empire, Greek remains the lingua franca in the East. So yes, continue, Marcus, the point you were going to make.
I don't know, all good. What I was going to say is that with the Gallic Empire, I think it's a case of, there's also a consideration of sort of strategic and military necessity. If you consider the sheer upheaval that occurred in the empire that, followed through, I'm trying to think, who was the emperor who was assassinated that sort of led to the crisis unraveling? The name's left me. Was it the last emperor of the Severan dynasty?
Yeah, Caracalla, no?
Thank you. Yes. When Caracalla died and sort of the crisis sort of started to begin to unfold, for the administrators of the province of Gaul and obviously initially of Britannia and Spain too, it was almost an act of necessity, because one thing I did want to actually talk about throughout the last sort of few minutes is what we kind of forget is that we have this sort of image of Gaul as being this sort of looted, pillaged, thoroughly sort of burnt out province that Caesar sort of hauls into the Roman sphere, and that's all true. But by the sort of second, third century, even sort of by the end of the first century almost, I mean, Gaul is a very productive and thoroughly economically thriving part of the country, even though the Rhine River, rather than being turned into an economic province because the expansion into Germany fails. But sort of with the exception of that militarized frontier, Gaul itself becomes quite a rich and productive province. Yeah. I mean, for instance, you have the very famous the aqueduct and mills at Barbagal on the outskirts of Arelato.
Yeah.
You have a lot of grain production. You have a lot of herds. You have these sort of towns which were previously Gallic oppida turned into quite successful sort of Roman planned cities with a lot of trade and a lot of the agricultural production. The population recovers extraordinarily with Roman colonization, obviously, but sort of the native population interbreeds and marries with the Romans, and Gaul becomes quite a model province for the empire. And I think, with the onset of the crisis, the local authorities were probably acting out of self-interest insofar they just didn't want to be sort of burnt and looted again.
Yeah, I mean, there was deep interest in, of course, keeping Gaul peaceful, because it was such a massive tax base. I mean, that's where I believe there's a reference in one of the ancient sources to the tribute of Gaul basically sustaining the German legions and the legions on the Rhine, And of course, that was actually a huge part of the economy, I mean, you had the procurators, who were sort of tax collectors, but they also were contractors and suppliers to the army, and they were operating on a massive scale here, transporting goods from Gaul to the German legions and vice versa.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yes, I think just in terms of sort of bringing up the chronology again. Again, thank you all for those points. The Gallic Empire itself doesn't last very long. It only lasts from 260 until 274. But of course, I think it's important to note that from 274 until 406, the empire goes significantly downhill. Just a little point I want to make in terms of the preservation of a Celtic civilization within Gaul itself. when I was doing my research, I discovered that the Bretons, you know, of course, the inhabitants of the modern region of Brittany, are not, in fact, you know, particularly related to this particular branch of the Gauls. However, they are the result of Britannic migrations during the 4th century. You know, ostensibly, the legendary founder of this new sort of Breton civilization is Conan Meriadoc. But I think it's important to note that when we think of Bretons today, they are not the, you know, continuation of Gallic civilization, but rather they are representing this you know, Western British Brythonic civilization, and there is no connection. But in terms of sort of continuing on this line, you mentioned, you know, preserving the legions on the Rhine. Around the year 406, we have the sack of Rome, and, you know, we have the collapse of, you know, much of the front in Pannonia, and the, you know, defeat of the Romans at the battle of the defeat of the Emperor Valens, the Battle of Adrianople, and the sack of Rome by Alaric and the Visigoths. And during this time, the legions of the Rhine again are unable to hold the Germans, basically expanding over. And so from 406 to 486, we have this process by which, you know, the provinces of Rome are basically, you know, continually raided and undermined. During the reign of the Emperor Majorian, probably the last effective Roman emperor, so, you know, we talk about the year 455, the Visigoths, the Burgundians, and the Franks begin to massively expand into, you know, the former provinces of Gaul. The Visigoths would acquire Aquitania. The Burgundians would occupy, you know, obviously modern-day Burgundy and, you know, Provence, and the Franks would create a new empire out of what was previously Belgica, which would become Austrasia, which, you know, no relation to Austria or Australia. But an interesting thing is during this time is that there is a rump state, a rump Roman state, that is able to hang on within the province of Gaul, led by a Roman general known as Aegidius, and this is known as the kingdom or domain of Soissons. And as far as I'm aware, I believe this rump state, this rump Roman state, actually is able to survive after the deposition of both Romulus Augustulus in 476 and of Julius Nepos in 480.
Yes, which would shows you, I suppose it shows you how tenacious the Romano-Gallic aristocrats could be when they're holding on to their power. But yeah, I mean, this is, of course, when you have the collapse of the Western Empire, the big thing that we see is the conflict between the migrating German peoples and or Germanic peoples and the Romanized Gallic populations. I mean the same thing, or Brythonic populations. I mean, in the case of England, we have the Angles and the Saxons coming. And we have groups like the Franks and the Goths. But the kingdom of Soissons did persist for some time until eventually it was subsumed under Clovis was the one who destroyed Soissons, I believe, right?
Well, yes, the Franks in general. I think, you know, in terms of like general mentions, I think it's also important the Romans did make, in some cases, you know, heroic resistance against the various invaders. So, for example, we have the victory of Flavius Aetius at the Battle of Chalons. Mm-hmm. In terms of what I really want to get onto is, you know, as part of an epilogue of this discussion, and as we're thinking forward to a French identity in particular, is how does Gaul and how does Roman Gaul persist and how does it survive during this period?
The interesting, an interesting reflection on this subject is, and I don't hear it often, but one thing that's always fascinated me for a very long time is that of all the Germanic peoples that cross the Rhine, and you might say pick at the sort of carcass of the Western Roman Empire, you know, the Teutons that remain on the east side of the Rhine continue as Germanic peoples, maintain their tongue, etc. Now the Franks technically are a Germanic tribe, a Germanic people, no different to the Suevi, the Vandals, the I suppose you could kind of put the Burgundians in this category also. But the Franks, rather than maintaining a Germanic tongue, adopt a Gallo-Latin tongue. They become sort of, you know, what we understand the French to be today, and it is through their language. They shed off the German and start speaking a Latin language, ironically.
Yeah, and I think this is because the Romanization of Gaul had gone very deep, you know, very deep indeed, and there was a huge interchange, and the as we've said, the noble classes enthusiastically took up this this new identity, whereas the older bearers of the culture, the Druids, etc., had been, as far as we can tell, pretty viciously wiped out. And so there was a huge infrastructural basis here that I suppose was just too tempting for the Franks to, you know, not adapt themselves to. Whereas the Germans, for whatever reason, seem to have not been up for that. They seem to have been in the mind to dominate and transmit their culture. I mean, we see what happened, of course, to the Romano-British populations, the Brythonic populations in England. You know, some of the genetic evidence that's coming out suggests, you know, a total pushing out of these peoples by the Angles and the Saxons, etc. And you don't see that with the Franks. And perhaps another reason for this is the relatively really large population. You know, the Franks simply couldn't do what the Angles and Saxons had done. So you have to have a situation of elite domination. You know, which did persist, at least in my opinion, up to, you know, the French Revolution, right?
Oh yes, very much so. And again, as we saw, this was also a continuous theme throughout Roman civilization in general. I think I mentioned the fact that the vast majority of people, you know, Gallics, the Gauls in particular, never, you know, became assimilated. I think it's also important to understand that this isn't just occurring throughout Gaul, but this is also happening through all of the supposedly, you know, Romance-speaking countries, where you have the denigration of formal or classical Latin into Vulgar Latin, and you have the fusion of Vulgar Latin with Calax of the Gallic language as well. So it does, you know, subsist during this period. I think, you know, Latin itself, classical Latin, is preserved as an elite tongue. But beyond that, you also have the emergence of early French. And in terms of the languages in particular, I think it's important to understand that this is in no way homogenous. You can say the language of France, you have the centralizing effects of the language in France, again, are the result of the French Revolution. In the south, again, the more Romanized elements, in the regions which were Narbonensis and Provence, we have the emergence of the Occitan language. And in the north, we have the emergence of the langue d'oil, which would become, you know, cosmopolitan French, what we would later known as Parisian French. There's one point, though, I think just before we leave the discussion, unless there are any points that you two would like to bring up. What do you think about the process of Christianization in Gaul?
Well, I was just going to bring that up as probably the most important lingering bastion of Rome, I guess. I mean, the Catholic Church, of course, continued in many traditions and brought many things to Gaul that I suppose had never really been there before. Gaul doesn't have a famous reputation for you know, schools of learning or academia or anything like this. It's only with the establishment of churches and monasteries, etc. And again, we see we're talking about the land of the Carnutes. I believe that the land of the Carnutes today is Chartres, you know, and the cathedral there, and so, which was you know, a very important center of French Catholicism, etc. So yeah, I think the church comes in, and the church in many ways continues the civilizing process in France. So yeah, I think Christianization we must talk about.
Yes, just a little backstory to that. Obviously, everyone should know the story of Christ, and we've mentioned it consistently on this channel. But in regard to the Christianization of Gaul, as we mentioned in our series on, you know, our episode on Roman Romanitas, and you can check it up, the history of the Christian Church regularly goes through, you know, periods of tolerance and persecution. And when we see the takeoff of Christianity in Gaul, it sort of really occurs during the 3rd century and beginning of the 4th century, when we have Constantine, you know, making Christianity a permitted language within the empire, even though it wouldn't become the official language until the reign of the Emperor Theodosius. You have the creation of various Frankish synods and the beginning of Frankish monasticism. But in terms of this subject in particular, it's something I really want to sort of go in depth and probably pursue more in terms of whether there's a particular strand of Gallic Christianity which would inform, you know, Gallicism, which is the later development in France, where, you know, France has a peculiar relationship of independence to the Holy See. And I think, you know, in terms of mentioning you're mentioning the site of Chartres. This very much comes in later. This is the result of the 12th century Renaissance. I was just wondering, do any of you know, again, any of the early church history as we're moving into the Magovians? Because in terms of when we're going to return back to France, the Christianization of France under the Magovians, the Carolingians, the baptism of Clovis will be the subject for the next debate. But just, you know, any lingering remarks that either of you want to make on the history of Christianity in Gaul through the third century into the sixth century?
I mean, I was just going to note that, it does go back quite far. We have records even under the, in the high point of the empire. I mean, Christianity, like a lot of religions at the time, actually seems to have spread in the urban centers, you know, primarily, because that's where people are traveling the most. That's where ideas travel. I mean, that's, you know, where the word pagan comes from. You know, pagan is associated with the countryside as opposed to the city. And so, yeah, it's no different. It's no different in Gaul. And one of the first places where we hear of Christianity in Gaul is in Lugdunum, which is a it's the great center of Gallic civilization, and we hear about the saint or the martyr Blandina, who was a young woman, and she refused to recant her faith, and so she was put through tortures in the arena in Lugdunum, as were other Christians. I mean, I'm pretty sure there were also persecutions there, in the Diocletianic persecution, etc. So there is a long history, especially in the large urban centers there, of a Christian presence. Yes,
I think there's the one thing you mentioned earlier, which is the sanctuary of the three Gauls, which is the inverse of this, which is what's the story of Gallo-Roman paganism during this period. You mentioned that it was this focal point for the religious establishment in Rome in Lugdunum. Do you know sort of what time period that we see the decline of the ancient form of Romanic Gallic syncretism and the, you know, replacement by Christianity?
I'd say it's around the same time that we see it elsewhere. I would say about 5th century. These things just seem to peter out, and we don't see any more artifacts. You know, we don't see any more cult statues, etc. And we see increasingly more Christian tombs, inscriptions, etc. And it just seems to have taken over. Yeah, around that time.
Yes, Marcus, is there anything you want to say on this topic? Marcus,
sorry. I think Columba basically sort of covered it. I have to say, sort of 3rd, 4th, 5th century Western sort of Christian history isn't my forte. But one thought I actually did have, sort of strangely enough, is that if I may share, the fact that the Gauls seem to be quite rapid adherence to, you know, Western Christianity that would sort of become the Catholic faith. If you sort of fast forward into the future, a few centuries between the British later in history becoming obviously Protestant and obviously the Germans, and Italy's more or less not gaining any or achieving any unity until much later in history, into the 1800s under Garibaldi and the Red Shirts, that sort of France and Spain being the main beneficiaries of this classical period of Romanization also inversely become these beating hearts of the Western forms of Christianity and of the Catholic faith, certainly in France up until the French Revolution. They sort of are these two standard bearers of Western Christianity that sort of stand through the ages up until the French Revolution. And I find it interesting that there's sort of this parallel between, you know, Gaul being this under Syagrius, this sort of last bastion of Gallo-Roman identity. And that is supplanted by being like a last bastion of Western Christianity along with Spain as well.
Yeah, and I think part of this is because, of course, Latin speaking could take root in the West, in Spain and in France, in a way that it, of course, just couldn't in the East. There was too much infrastructure. There was too much use of Greek. It was too deeply ingrained at a very... a complex level, you know, in terms of academic culture, etc. Whereas in the West, it was more of a blank canvas, if you will. And Latin took hold so much more strongly. And so, I'm in agreement 100%.
Yes. So I think before we finish up here, Columba, Marcus, are there any sort of final points you want to put across?
Not so much a final point, but like I did say to you before, I have that excerpt from a paper I'd like to share, if that's okay with you.
Absolutely, go ahead.
Sure.
Just for some reference for yourselves and the audience, it was a paper written in regards to sort of Byzantium being a sort of bulwark against the expansion of Islam. But I do touch on the West in it, so I figured this sort of is two relatively small paragraphs, so I'll start. Like Byzantium, the West shared a common inheritance with ancient Rome. Though there were differences in geography, language, cultural lineage, and after the Great Schism of 1054, religion. In the West, however, the early Middle Ages have traditionally been seen as more Germanic than late Rome, the product of invasion, and also as the location of a cultural Romano-Germanic fusion, which would be developed and perfected under the Carolingians. Still, there were commonalities shared by people who live both beyond the reach of the Roman world and that of the Germanic post-Roman Europe. Early medieval societies in the West had common features whether there had been invasion or not. Byzantine Italy and Wales were in many ways parallel to Lombard Italy and England respectively. Ireland too, with little contact with the Germanic world, had similarities with it. So that the elements that constituted post-Roman culture in the West thus became the basis upon which the various kingdoms of Western Europe would emerge. This mingling of Gallo-Roman, Christian, and barbarian traditions slowly created a new European culture. It was chiefly thanks to Charlemagne's grandfather, though, Charles Martel, that ensured that this cultural fusion was given necessary time and space as to materialize. In essence, when the Muslim armies attacked Francia in the early 730s, his leadership provided a united response. His greatest victory came in 732 when he turned back the Arab force at the Battle of Tours-Poitiers. But he won many other battles over Muslims and Christians alike, consolidating his power over the Franks and extending the boundaries of the Frankish state. I think that reflection there regarding the various influences of fusion between traditions and peoples and languages, and that sort of France becomes this sort of standout exponent of that, is quite a, you know, pertinent to what we're talking about.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's sort of the lingering sort of element that we'll have as we go into the focus on French identity, is this lingering French particularism, which comes out of this hybridization of Romanic Gallic culture. And again, I think the counter to that, which is, you know, important to know, we're not going to be focusing on England in this particular subject, how mm-hmm. Unlike in France, where you have this genetic continuity, you have this linguistic continuity, in many aspects you have this cultural continuity. In England, the Anglo-Saxon invasion is able to destroy much of the Western Celtic civilization, you know, that of East Anglia, that of the Iceni. And when we have Celtic civilization, the Brythonic Celtic civilization, it is expressed in Wales, it is expressed in Ireland, it is expressed in Scots Gaelic, and it is ironically expressed within France itself, in Brittany. And the inverse of that, of course, is that, you know, France, probably, you know, as much as Italy, is this continuity of the legacy of the Roman Empire and of the Gallic civilization. So, Columba, do you have any final points you want to make?
The one thing that I would say, and this sort of leads into next week when we're going to be talking about Germania and Germany, and we've sort of touched on this with Germania Inferior, and we must understand that at this point in time, in the classical world, in the ancient world, and at the very beginning of the Middle Ages, there was huge interchange between the German and French civilizations, etc. And this interchange, the common interactions, and the level of infrastructure and communication that had been built up, laid the foundations for Charlemagne's state building, etc., which of course absolutely key for the preservation of texts, etc., the expansion of European civilization, and you know, we all know where that goes. So yeah, we need to get and of course, you know, Germany and France, you know, you had East and West Francia, etc. And so these ideas were all bound together. But I also wonder just as a final thought, this idea of the total separation, this extreme separation that existed between the knightly aristocrat class and the commoners, even in Caesar's time, I wonder to what extent this allowed or made made it more easy for the Franks to come in and set up a system of elite domination where there was very little interaction or say from the peasantry, you know. And that also goes some way towards explaining the vast differences in terms of language, etc., that we will see in French, you know, commoner communities all the way up to the time of the revolution, because they're just being dominated by this Frankish ruling class. So yeah, I think that's an interesting observation to make. But apart from that, I think that's about me.
Yes, and these are all important questions that will follow us throughout the course of this series. In terms of the next episodes on this series, we are going to be focusing on, as Columba said, Germania before the Great Migrations. And our third episode on this series will focus on the Great Migrations and the collapse of the Roman Empire in particular, and especially in Italy. Before we go, though, as we have no super chats, so we can get out of here quickly, Marcus, thank you very much for coming on. Is there anything you would like to shill?
Not necessarily, aside from the fact that you did share my Twitter handle in the tweet, but you know, I was quite honored the fact that you asked me on, so I'll just take what I have. But no, I've had a very thorough, I've thoroughly enjoyed myself. Thank you very much for the discussion. I hope I've contributed something of value. And no, thank you. And for everyone listening, thank you for your time. Thank you, IM. Thank you, Columba. Much appreciated.
And absolutely, Marcus, it's been wonderful to have you on. You've been a great guest and we're very lucky to have you. Columba, anything you want to share?
No, not today. I'm just gonna log off and then go and panic about this Pentagon microchip story that Pharaoh shared. Oh. But yeah,
crossing over into current events. But okay. So thank you very much for that, Columba. Thank you everyone very much for listening. We'll be back at the same time next week. Oh, one more thing is that on next Wednesday at 9, I will be hosting a stream on the historical influences, inspirations behind Tolkien's Legendarium with Nathan Hood. So please tune in for that and good night.